coming up.
I was with a group of Malawian visiting a judge and prisons officials. We took them to Atteridgeville. 30%, one third of the women's prison at Atteridgeville, the Women's Gender Responsive Center, correctional center, are on ARVs. And that's higher than I've seen in other prisons, which is about 25%, consistently at prisons. Now, I find it mysterious, Professor, because our national prevalence, Dr. Nhlanhla and I might have got our figures mixed. I think it's almost 7 million on ARVs, but we've got a higher prevalence, about 14-15%. But in any event, Professor, it's much higher inside prison than outside.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Let's Talk Man with the Gents Clinic. Six South African male medical doctors on a mission to change the way in which we perceive healthcare. Today we've got two very interesting guests joining us from afar and in person. We're going to be discussing HIV, the science and the stigma. Joined with us in studio here today is Judge Edwin Cameron. Let's give him a big round of applause. Judge Edwin Cameron is a former constitutional court judge. He lives with HIV, and he's here to talk about his experiences. So thank you and welcome to the podcast. Joined with us from afar remotely, we've got Professor Tumbi Ndungu from the University of KwaZulu-Natal. He's a professor in HIV and TB research, currently heading as the scientific director of HIV pathogenesis. So thank you for joining us and welcome to the podcast. Thank you. All right. To start off the discussion, first question I have for Prof. Ndungu. Can you maybe, I think a lot of our viewers are very interested in HIV and the current research that's going on. Maybe if you could just take us through the history or timeline of treatment for HIV.
Thank you very much for having me on. I think that as most of the viewers and listeners will know, HIV came about as a new disease in the early 1980s. And of course, at that time, there was no treatment for HIV. And so a diagnosis of HIV at that time was considered almost like a death sentence in the sense that there was no treatment. But very soon after HIV was discovered, we were able to develop drugs, monotherapy, what you used to call monotherapy, AZT primarily, which was associated with the very fast development of resistance. It was not very good. It was very toxic. And then in the mid-1990s, that's when we really started to develop combinations of drugs, drugs that target various steps in the life cycle of HIV. And these drugs, the combination drugs, were very, very effective. In the beginning, they were also fairly toxic, and somebody had to take very many tablets per day. But things have changed dramatically, such that today you only have to take one tablet of HIV in order to remain healthy. And the safety profile for the most part of these drugs is now very good. Most people are able to live with HIV, very healthy lives. Mm-hmm. And so we have had a huge scientific revolution in terms of the improvement of medication to treat HIV.
Interesting.
Very, very interesting.
Yeah.
Before I ask you my next question, which is about the current research that's ongoing with regards to treatment, we've heard of, a lot of people have heard of this magical cure. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether it's true or not. But before we get to that, I think, Judge, a question that we'd like to ask. So he did mention that, the prevalence of diagnosis came about in the 70s.
Yeah.
And obviously it was... the prevalence picked up, and probably the amount of testing that was ongoing also picked up. But maybe you can walk us through your journey, the discovery of your diagnosis, time it came about in your life, and the treatment that was offered to you at the time, and how things have improved since.
Thank you very much. I'm really pleased to be here. And our professor, Professor Ndungu, has just told my life story. Mm-hmm. I was infected with HIV a very long time ago. I was a young man. I'd started my career at the Johannesburg Bar as a human rights practitioner. Mm. And I was 32 years old when I was infected with HIV. I calculated it to an event over Easter in 1985. And as Professor Ndungu says, it was a death sentence, but I think an important thing one must add, this was at the time, and maybe still is, one of the most stigmatized diseases in human history. Mm-hmm. Why is it stigmatized? For a variety of reasons. The people amongst whom it was first manifested, mm-hmm. and it was manifested first in June 1981 in the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly reports of the United States CDC, were people like me, young queer men, at the height of their powers. I had a career ahead of me, and they started dying. Hundreds of thousands of young queer men in Australasia, in Western, East Coast, West Coast, Western Europe, Canada. And what the epidemiologists didn't know at that point was that people in Africa, Central Africa, Uganda particularly, were also dying. Stigma, black people, queer people, single men, people condemned for their sex. Mm-hmm. Now, I can testify, and I've said it as a gay man, yes, gay men do have a lot of sex. And it's something to do with male males. I haven't thought about it myself, anthropologically or psychologically. But that stigma got transferred to black Africans. And President Mbeki eventually picked this up. He was enraged by the science of HIV and by its epidemiology. He said, you white scientists are telling us that we are having sex with gay abandon. So I want to get back to the question of stigma, doctor, which is the almost worse than knowing that I would certainly die before I was 40. I'd never see a democratic South Africa. I'd never become a judge, was the stigma and the profound shame. And I've spent much of my life in HIV since then, alongside my career as a lawyer and a judge, trying to fight this stigma. Mm. It's not easy. It's to do with the marginalized groups, poor black, heterosexual Africans, queer men, many of them affluent, not all of them, but also it's about sex. And that's why I've come onto your podcast, and I'm honored to be on the podcast, because we've got to talk about sex. How do you have sex? Mm. Is it penovaginal? Is it insertive anal? Is it receptive anal? We've got to talk about all of those things in order to address the stigma. So I just want to complete my life journey with the professor, and thank you, Professor, for telling my life journey. I fell ill after 11 years with HIV. I hoped that I would escape it. The answer is you cannot escape AIDS when you've got HIV, except in very, very rare circumstances. But I fell ill at about the time that combination therapy was becoming available, 1996. And as Professor Ndungu says, the first treatments, my doctor put me on protease inhibitors. It was horrible. I had to refrigerate them, take 8 tablets twice a day, catastrophic gastric effects and peripheral neuropathies. Now, 27 years later, I take 1 tablet of Ecriptiga a day, and I'm with about 7 million South Africans. That's an important thing. That's about 13 to 14% of all of us in South Africa are living with HIV and AIDS. Sure. And as Professor Tumbi Ndungu says, the treatment is now almost entirely easy. If you've got hypertension or you've got insulin-dependent diabetes, you've got my sympathy, because it's much more difficult than what my life.
Exactly.
That's true.
Yeah. Prof, just from me, I think I'm still just, you know, mind boggled at the fact that I'm sitting next to you, because you are a true legend.
Thank you. Sorry about the microphone.
No problem. Thank you. But I just want to know, I mean, especially after listening to your story, I mean, where did you get the courage, especially in that time where, like you're saying, HIV was so stigmatized? You were a young professional, you know, trying to get on top of your field, you know, to then come out and say, you know what, guys, this is where I am. This is what I've contacted. And yeah, judge me all you want.
I was exactly. And thank you for asking that, Dr. Nhlanhla. I was very scared for a very long time, and I kept it very quiet. What changed for me was two people, and they were both black people. And I mention their race because race is so significant. Simon Nkordi, a queer man like myself, a brave queer man who fought for South Africa's freedom from apartheid, fought for queer liberation, fought for HIV treatment and stigma, and then Gugu Dlamini. They both died in December 1998. And by that time, I had got my health and strength back. After 15 months on these near miraculous drugs, my life has given back to me. So I felt an imperative to talk. But Gugu Dlamini dies on the streets of Umlazi, attacked by her former sexual partners, her neighbors, for speaking out on what was then Radio Zulu. And Simon dies in the Charlotte Maxeke Hospital. Some of us were with him when he died, but I knew that I couldn't sue. So I only spoke out in April 1999. It's a long time ago. I thought other people, to get back to your point about stigma, would also speak out. We have working class and marginalized and dispossessed people who speak more freely about their own HIV than people who in the political elite, the journalism elite, the soccer elite, the entertainment elite. Yeah. And we know that 13% of them have got HIV because the rest of us are 13% HIV. So there's still a massive stigma.
Okay. I think let's move back to Prof. Ndungu. Prof, the question that I have is regarding current treatment modalities. I know the layman in the street just says, well, hey, you know, we've developed cures for everything else now, and, you know.
I mean, look at how we treated COVID. You know, COVID within
COVID came,
2 years,
and there was a vaccine. You know? And why is it so? I think the question that most people probably want to know is, why is it so difficult to treat HIV, and why is it difficult to find a cure for HIV specifically?
Thank you for that question. I think there are two reasons why it is so difficult to find a cure for HIV. One reason is that HIV, by its very nature as a virus, integrates into our genomes. In other words, in its life cycle, it gets into our DNA, and once it's in there, it's very, very difficult to get it out, and it's a progressive infection. There is nobody that we know of that has been naturally cured of HIV. So unlike other viruses where you can get the virus infects your body, but then your immune system is able to clear it, there is no record of the immune system, a person's immune system being able to clear HIV. And so we don't have any evidence of how the immune system can clear HIV so that we can learn from that. And that's very different from something like the SARS-CoV-2 virus, which causes COVID, where you can get infected, but then you're able to clear the virus. Your immune system can clear the virus. And so we can learn a lot from people that have been able to clear the virus and be able to develop ways to basically recapitulate that in people who get COVID, for example. So that's one reason. The fact that the natural history of HIV is quite different, and it is such that it integrates into the human genome, and it's able to, it's not easy to get rid of it. And there is no way that the immune system by itself can control the virus in most people. The second reason, perhaps the most important reason, is the genetic, what we call the genetic variability of HIV. HIV is one of the most mutable viruses. In other words, every time the virus replicates in the body, in the absence of antiretroviral therapy, it causes a mutation in the virus. And who is living with HIV, what you have is not just one strain of the virus. It's a, what we call, in scientific terms, we call it a quasi species. In other words, there are many closely related viruses, mm-hmm. but each of them distinct that are living in the body. And it is very, very difficult to develop a vaccine against those viruses because they are so diverse. Because you don't know what you're actually going to encounter when somebody gets exposed to HIV. A good example of this is influenza. In the case of influenza virus, we have to get a vaccine and we have to change that vaccine every year in order to keep up with the mutating virus. Now, HIV is actually much more mutable than the influenza virus, much more than the COVID virus. And that's one of the reasons why scientifically it is so difficult to make a vaccine that can protect everybody against HIV. So that doesn't mean that it is impossible, but we certainly need to learn much more in order for us to make a successful vaccine against HIV than we have the knowledge at the moment.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. And then, Prof, you know, I've once had a patient, now that you're speaking about, you know, just explaining to some, especially patients, explaining to them, why is it that, you know, we're struggling so much to get to something to sort of eradicate HIV? And I spoke to them about how, you know, it integrates into your DNA. And interestingly, this patient asked me, but doc, if you're saying it's in your DNA, why don't you pass it on to your kids? Do you mind just explaining that debacle? Where the misunderstanding might be? Why is it that if it's in your genome, you don't share it with your offspring?
Yeah, so actually, even though it HIV integrates into the genome, it doesn't mean that it is in every cell in your body. It is actually in a specific cell in your body, a particular immune cell called the CD4 cell. Now, you need the CD4 cells in order to fight off infections. So it doesn't mean that the virus is in every single cell in your body. In fact, it doesn't go into the cells that are involved in reproduction, but it does go into the cells that are involved in immune response.
Yeah.
And it persists in those cells that are involved in the immune response. So the virus cannot be transmitted, for example, through to children, to the offspring of somebody who is living with HIV, through the normal reproduction process, but it is there in the immune cells in the body. Even mm-hmm. when somebody is taking antiretroviral therapy, mm-hmm. there remains what we call a reservoir,
yeah. mm-hmm.
a small number of cells, immune cells that still harbor the virus, but are very difficult to actually figure out which cells those are, mm-hmm. because we don't have a marker for those cells. And that's mm-hmm. why it's so difficult to actually completely eradicate and cure HIV from the body.
Could I just add that if I stop taking my daily tablet of 3 antiretrovirals, which are keeping my virus suppressed, I will, I don't know how long, maybe 6 weeks, 12 weeks, I will start getting ill, I will start getting fatigued, and the virus will be resurgent.
Mm-hmm. What's the longest period of time you maybe had to, either you were changing treatments or you were moving from one to the other, that you've been off treatment?
I haven't been off treatment. And my viral load was last detectable, a viral load blip in 1999. So I've been very lucky with my treatment. It succeeded, and I've been very well. I've been, I could have told the researchers that you've got to start people on ARV treatment immediately on diagnosis.
Mm.
You shouldn't wait. There was massive tests conducted about 10 years ago which came to that conclusion. From my own experience, I would have told people that, and that's why I've been so adherent to my treatment, because I know that if I'm not adherent, I will fall ill again. I never want to. I was very ill indeed. I don't ever want to be ill like that again. I think most people watching this podcast have seen people in South Africa or the rest of Africa, in Kenya, where the professor was born. We've seen, we've all had personal experience of that, and we don't want it to replicate.
Vish, any questions?
I think you've, and thanks for being on the podcast, Judge. I think you guys have asked quite a lot of questions. In terms of your treatments, obviously you've changed treatments once the fixed dose combination was available. Have you ever changed treatments, either secondary to like virological failure or renal dysfunction?
I was,
or drug to drug interactions?
I was on a different treatment. My doctor tried to take me off AZT, which, as the professor said, is a very toxic in monotherapy. AZT works for about 12 to 16 months and then it stops working. And your body is weakened because of it. So he took me off it, and that's when I had the blip. But I've stayed on treatments, and I'm very grateful for that. I was treatment naive. Simon, my hero, Simon and Cordy, the young man from the Vol, he had taken successive mono treatments. So when he tried a triple combination, it didn't work for him. So, but I do want to say, since you're all medical doctors treating people, for me, if as a lay person in medicine, the introduction of tenofovir really made me feel good. I experienced it. It's part of what I take in a cryptiga. I was taking it in duo combination plus with a third tablet, and then they combined it in what is the default treatment now in South Africa. There are millions of us taking our cryptidig every day, and I hope that all your viewers do so religiously.
Yeah. I mean, talking about, you know, what Judge just mentioned, the fact that we have 13% of our population who actually take this medication. I'm just thinking about, you know, what's currently happening, the current sort of political landscape, you know, with the United States withdrawing some of its funding. Prof, do you think this will also, I know we haven't really touched on what you're currently working on, but do you have any fears, you know, with the US withdrawing some of its funding, or any of the projects that you're currently working on funded by USAID?
Yes, I do have a lot of fears. And in fact, I'm one of the victims as a researcher of the cut in funding. We had a project funded by USAID that has been looking at vaccine development, particularly for the subtypes that are found in Africa, which are different from the subtypes that you find in Europe and North America. We have non-B subtypes. Subtypes A, C, and D are the commonest here in Africa. And we had some work ongoing to try and develop a vaccine against these subtypes. And that work has had to stop because of the cut in funding from USAID. Mm-hmm. But it's not just the research. It's also the programs. There have been some estimates. I've seen some in journals saying that there's going to be about 25 million excess deaths over the next 15 years as a result of the halting of the PEPFAR program. So this is massive impact. This is going to impact people. Mm-hmm. And it's very unfortunate that this is happening. And but I think that it calls for us as a global community, in Africa especially, to turn a little bit more inwards and become less dependent on other countries to develop solutions. And that's why I'm very passionate about the work that I do as a researcher, because I feel that what we need to do going into the future, if you look at the drugs that we are talking about, the judge has so eloquently explained, are very effective. We have had to depend on other countries to develop these medications. And so I think, although it's sad what is happening in the global arena, and you could say that we don't have the resources, But I think we do have some resources, and we can do better with the resources that we have in terms of supporting local innovation, supporting young people to become scientists, because these things were not developed out of the blue. These drugs, this medication, scientific innovation comes from hard work, and it comes from investment. And we need to invest in our own future, in our own scientific future, so that we can be the people that begin to develop these kinds of interventions going forward, including a cure for HIV.
And
I want to ask the professor.
Okay, I think let's ask the professor.
Professor, can I ask you an epidemiological question?
Absolutely, Judge.
Lovely. I retired from the Constitutional Court almost 6 years ago, and then President Ramaphosa appointed me as Inspecting Judge of Prisons, which has been a preoccupation of my lawyer's life for a long time. Consistently, when I go into a prison, I always ask to see the pharmacy, I always ask to see their ARVs, and obviously TB and hypertension drugs and other questions. We ask them, are there stockouts? Mm-hmm. But one question I always ask is, how many people in this prison are on ARVs? And on Tuesday, I was with a group of Malawian visiting a judge and prisons officials. We took them to Attridgeville. 30%, one-third of the women's prison at Attridgeville, the Women's Gender Responsive Center, correctional center, are on ARVs. And that's higher than I've seen in other prisons, which is about 25% consistently at prisons. Now, I find it mysterious, Professor, because our national prevalence, Dr. Nklantha and I might have got our figures mixed. I think it's almost 7 million on ARVs, but we've got a higher prevalence about 14-15%. But in any event, Professor, it's much higher inside prison than outside. And this is a consistent finding since I've been Inspecting Judge of Prisons. So I'm intrigued about that. I've speculated about the possible causes, but you, as one of the continent's most foremost researchers, can maybe solve this conundrum for me.
Judge, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to solve that one. I am a virologist rather than an epidemiologist.
Yes.
But having said that, I do think that perhaps part of the explanation for it might be that HIV at its core, as you know, it's a social disease.
Mm. Mm.
And by that I mean it does disproportionately impact people who's, particularly here in Africa, people whose socioeconomic status is low. They are disproportionately impacted by HIV. And a lot of people who are vulnerable, particularly women who are vulnerable to HIV, are living in very difficult socioeconomic circumstances. And I do think that that probably might explain why, particularly, as you mentioned, in women prisons, you tend to see that a lot of women would be on antiretroviral therapy who are in prison, because these are individuals that are coming from difficult socioeconomic circumstances, and that may have been a factor into them ending up in these institutions. So that would be my guess. Caution that I'm not, this is not an area that I've studied, but that's what I would guess.
May I just say, Doctor, that we did think at the start of when the epidemic really hit us, when we realized in the late 1980s that it was going to affect people, especially on the mines, the single-sex hostels and so on. We thought also that it was socioeconomically defined, but the household surveys that the Nelson Mandela Foundation and the Human Sciences Research Council did found the professor is right that there is a prevalence disparity between upper income groups and more economically under-resourced groups, but it's not so big. It's 8 or 9% versus 10 or 11%. So that would explain it partly. But we know, you look at any group, a dazzling party or a group of MPs or a group of cabinet ministers, they've also got almost 14% prevalence. No, perhaps a little less. But thank you very much, Professor. I'm glad to put you on the spot as an epidemiologist as well as a virologist.
Yeah.
Fish,
yeah,
had,
no problem.
You had a question before
class. Oh yeah, sorry, Judge. I also wanted to ask. So obviously, as we were talking about socioeconomic status as well, do you feel like living with HIV, knowing your like socioeconomic status, has been? Would you say it would be easier, or would it be like on par as like people that, I mean, we generally would treat with a slightly lower socioeconomic status?
It's such a beautiful question. I was able to start treatment because I was a judge and because I could spend a third of my then judge's salary from the end of 1997 on these fantastically expensive drugs. So, and it was because I was judge that I was able to speak out. I knew I had a guaranteed job unless Parliament removed me. So I do think that people are more vulnerable. I've never called for anyone ever to speak out about their own HIV status. Like I've never called a man who is having sex with other men to identify as gay or anything else. But I do think it would be very helpful if more people did speak out, because we don't have people in the affluent and elite groups who articulate their own HIV. Mm-hmm. And I want to get back to the question of stigma, because I think there is external stigma, undoubtedly, because, you know, why are you queer? Why did you sleep with another lady next door? Is your husband? The wife is often blamed, by the way, for as Professor Ndunguru indicates. But I think the important thing to add is that there's also an internalization of stigma. People blame themselves. And I think that internalized stigma with HIV is very powerful. It keeps people silent. It keeps them ashamed. It keeps them from not speaking out.
But I can imagine it must be challenging. You know, I've always thought to myself, if I were to, for example, wake up and with this diagnosis, I mean, I always think to myself, you know, who would I look for? Who will I blame? So whenever I hear a patient say to me, you know, after you've told them the diagnosis, I always knew he was cheating or this. You know, I always try and sort of bring them down to reality as well. So the fact that, I mean, yes, it could have been him. Yes, it could have been a relationship you had 5 years ago, by the way, before you met him. You just didn't test, and for some reason, you didn't show any symptoms. But more importantly, I mean, to deal with the current problem, you know. And not sort of obsess too much about, but I mean, it's in human nature to try and sort of pin it down to a day or a person.
But it also goes back to the question of sexual blame, because there are cases of deliberate infection, there are cases of deliberate concealment. I don't tell a sexual partner with whom I'm having unprotected sex. Mm-hmm. But most times it's two innocent people who are seeking intimacy and love and companionship and physical closeness, and we can't blame that.
Yeah.
So, look, Prof. Ndunguru needs to leave us soon. And before he does, there are a few questions I quickly wanted to ask. Currently, I mean, we heard of, it was all over the news, a lot of people were very interested in, is there a cure for HIV on the horizon? And maybe, Prof, you can let us know what research you're currently working on.
Thank you very much for that question. So we have had a study recently, and the study is, the goal of the study is to see whether you can achieve what we are calling ART-free control of HIV. In other words, as we have discussed, at the moment, if somebody is living with HIV, they need to be on antiretroviral medication in order for them to be healthy and to control the virus, so that the virus also it benefits them, their health becomes almost normal, like that's somebody who doesn't have HIV, and also they cannot transmit the virus to somebody else. And I say it almost normal because there's a lot of research showing that people living with HIV, even when they are fully controlled HIV, they still have some immune dysfunction that persists. So, for example, they are more likely to develop cardiovascular disease or even an infection like TB and so on for reasons that we don't fully understand. But the other thing is that there is fatigue in terms of taking antiretroviral.
Sorry, Professor, for interrupting you, Professor. I do beg your pardon, but you're again telling my story. I've just been diagnosed with atrial fibrillation at the age of 72, and I thought I've been reading those journal articles myself, but I interrupted you, sir, and you were asked a very important question about your research. But you've been telling my life story this whole afternoon.
I think it's all in order, and thank you for interrupting, because I think people need to see that this is actually real. And so I don't mind the interruption. So our goal then of the research that we are doing is to see, is there a way you can control HIV without antiretroviral medication? Because a lot of people who are living with HIV would like to be able to take time off without having to take antiretroviral medication for every single day. But the problem is that if you stop taking antiretroviral medication, the virus rebounds within about 2 to 3 weeks.
Why?
So we decided to do a study where we, in women, where we started antiretroviral treatment very early after they got HIV infected. So we have a cohort of women that we follow very closely in Durban. And those women, some of them got infected when we were following them up. So we knew when they got infected, and we started them on antiretroviral therapy immediately.
Mm.
So the immune system is very good because they started the treatment quite early. And we wanted to do this study where we wanted to check whether if you give them something that boosts their immune response and then ask them to interrupt antiretroviral therapy under very close clinical monitoring, would the virus actually come back, or would they be able to control the virus? So it was a small study, and what we found is that it involved 20 women. All of them were women. And what we found is that within about 20 weeks, 7 of the women had rebounded, the virus had come back.
Mm.
And then between 16 weeks and 44 weeks, another 7 women experienced a viral rebound. In other words, the virus came back.
Mm-hmm.
But we had 4 women who stayed for 4 years, for a year, without the virus rebounding. And they were not taking antiretroviral medication because we were closely monitoring them for their viral load every week. We were also monitoring their CD4 count so that if we saw anything, we could put them back on antiretroviral medication. So it's a small study. It doesn't mean that these individuals are cured of HIV, but it shows that actually there are strategies involving immunotherapy that might work in terms of inducing and boosting the immune response so that the immune response can control the virus by itself. Now, this intervention at the moment is not good enough for us to roll it out widely. In fact, we are not taking it forward because it worked in only 20% of individuals.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very important research that is a proof of concept that this might actually work in future. And we are doing a lot of now laboratory research in the people that it worked to try and see whether we can understand the mechanisms. Mm-hmm. And if we can understand the mechanisms, we might be able to move this work forward towards an HIV cure eventually, which is what we would like to achieve eventually.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Prof, how long were the 4 women on ARVs for until you stopped their treatment? The 4 that didn't rebound.
The women had to be on ARVs for at least 1 year before we stopped treatment. But actually, in our study, most of these women were on antiretroviral therapy for 6.5 years, almost 7 years. They had been taking antiretroviral therapy for 7 years before they went into this clinical trial.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see that This accurate study tells us that curing HIV is not going to be easy, because what it shows is that despite the fact that these women had very little exposure to the virus, and given the fact that they started treatment very early, and also they had been on treatment for, on average, 7 years, 16 out of 20, the virus still rebounded quite early, within a few months. However, the fact that we had four that were able to remain off antiretroviral therapy for a year, and in fact, some of them are still off antiretroviral therapy even now as we speak, this tells us that this kind of approach might work if we can understand it better and be able to boost it.
Okay, any final questions for Prof before we release him?
Prof, before we release you, just out of curiosity, I mean, with these four women who, to me, are obviously a huge success. I know it's a small number, but in terms of HIV research, I think there's a lot to learn from them. Do you find that Big Pharma is interested in you know, in being part of learning? And is there an interest, do you think, in these big pharmaceutical companies to help in understanding how these women are able to maintain
and essentially to find suppression? A cure? Because we often, you know, patients will talk about, you know, it's big pharmaceuticals that don't want to cure cancer, don't want to cure HIV because they make more money by selling you the drugs, taking something every day versus a once-off cure. Do you think there's any truth to this?
I actually don't want to speak for pharmaceutical companies, but I have to say that this particular study that we did, the one that I'm talking about, we did it in collaboration with a pharmaceutical company, Gilead. And I'm it's not a secret. They are a pharmaceutical company that makes antiretroviral drugs. So in my own experience, what I have seen, and I'm speaking as an academic, as somebody who doesn't understand pharmaceutical companies from the inside, but my own experience has been that actually, we can work collaboratively in partnerships with pharmaceutical companies in order to move, to make progress towards developing a cure for HIV. And in our study, we had collaboration between a pharmaceutical company, ourselves in academia, and most importantly, the community. Because in order for us to do this work, we had to educate the community and work with the community to try and explain what we wanted to achieve and why we were doing it. And this would not have happened, this research would not have happened without the partnership of those three groups, the investigators in academia, the pharmaceutical company, and the community. So I think partnerships are very important. I believe in the power of partnerships, and I think that we should promote these kind of partnerships to, in order for us to make progress as a society.
Could I add one quick thing, Professor? I'm generally supporting exactly what the professor says. The drugs I take cost my medical insurance 222 rand a month. When I started on ARVs, my drugs were costing me then prices 28 years ago, 4,500 rand a month. So the prices have contracted, especially because of the deal that the Treatment Action Campaign, which Zaki Ahmed led to bring down the drug prices, and eventually the Indian drug manufacturers and brokered a deal with the Bill and Gates, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Clinton Foundation. So in Africa, there is no profit whatsoever for the drug companies to rather perpetuate. I think there may well be profit in a cure for Africa, because we are 30 million Africans, and all of us would want the cure.
Well, thank you very much, Prof. Ndungu, for joining us. We know you have to leave. We're going to ask the judge a few more questions, but thank you for joining us, and we really appreciate your time.
Well, what a brilliant show to be part of. Thank you so much for inviting me, and it's also a great pleasure to have participated in this panel discussion with Judge Cameron, who is a real hero for all of us in this who work in this field. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Prof.
Thanks, Prof.
Thank you for having us. So, Judge, a few more questions, because we also have to wrap up shortly. Vish and Tlantla, any questions that you guys wanted to ask?
No, I just wanted to point out. So my wife is a senior associate at Bowman Gifford.
Uh-huh.
She actually clerked at the court when you were still there. And it's TD Vilagazi.
Oh, wonderful. Yes, absolutely wonderful.
Yes, I just wanted to mention
that. No, I'm glad you do. Yeah, please pass so my excited. Warmest thoughts. How wonderful.
I will.
Which judge did you work for? I'm trying to think.
I think in Kabinde.
Yes.
Judge in Kabinde. Yeah, so, I think so.
Lovely. Thank you.
She'll be so proud of me that I remember one of these things.
Exactly.
I don't know what's going on.
Wonderful. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, I think Ntlatla is just doing that for brownie points.
Exactly.
She watches this episode.
Exactly.
Important. Vish, you have anything? Or do you want me to ask my question? So,
yeah.
Judge... I think something that's obviously very important, and you did touch on it a bit, right? Obviously identifying openly as, you know, homosexual, there's a lot of stigma attached to HIV, as you mentioned, and probably more so within the queer community.
Yeah, I think that's true, actually.
What do you think are some of the challenges that face the community when it comes to HIV? Because you mentioned, you know, like, you know, gay men have a lot more sex. Do you think? And I actually, funny enough, I had this conversation with a friend of mine who's also homosexual, and he mentioned that he thinks the reason why men, not just physiologically, you know, have higher libido or whatever, like it's a physical thing that, and that's why they have more sex. He said he actually thinks that the reason why gay men have more sex is because, or more casual sex rather, is because they feel like they've been told that they're not allowed to be in a relationship. A monogamous relationship or marriage is reserved for heterosexual people. So if I can't have that and that's never going to be accepted, you know, my family will accept that I'm just a single man having fun out there, but they definitely are not going to accept me if I have to bring a steady partner home. Do you think there's much, or maybe you can just talk about your experience or your thoughts on this?
Thank you very much. I think we've got to start by saying we're on terribly dangerous terrain now. We've all got to be careful that we're not all going to get cancelled. So it's a
difficult thing. Scared, don't worry.
Well, I'm scared.
Yes, absolutely. Imagine being cancelled. So I think these social factors are subtle. I think what your friend said has got force, that the marginalization of queer people, LGBTIQ people, and this is intensifying with the Trump onslaught on justice and fairness and DEI in the United States. And it's having ripple effects in Uganda, in Ghana, in Nigeria, and in Eastern Europe. So I think that that's going to intensify. That sense that there's something violative, transgressive about being queer, about having queer sex. I do think, in my case, certainly coming out was also affirmed by experiencing sex, which I'd never had gay sex before. So I do think there's something in that. I do also think, and here again we are on terribly dangerous cancelled territory. I think the fact that two men have gay sex is also a reflection on the more. Now, please counsel me. The more predatory nature of a man's sexual engagement or sexual search. We're not talking about all men. We're not talking about all queer men or all gay men or men who have sex with men. But I think those factors are present there. And I think that the obviously it's to do with the permeability of the anal lining. The risk amongst gay men for the receptive partner in insertive, ejaculative anal sex is enormously high. And I want to come back to the race issue because President Mbeki, like a lot of racists, implied that the reason that the HIV epidemic is so colossal in Central and Southern Africa, in Africa, that being the mistake they made, is because black people have sex differently. No, that's a terrible myth. Because if it were that black people had sex differently or more sex, why is there no generalized epidemic anywhere outside Central and Southern Africa. Yeah. From South Sudan downwards, West Africa, all of my Nigerian friends would be greatly offended if we said they had less sex than Central and Southern Africans. We're all going to get cancelled in Planta.
We're getting cancelled.
But the truth is that I do not believe that there's any less expansive practice sexuality in West Africa than there is in Central and Southern Africa. My view is that there's a genetic susceptibility, a terrible genetic vulnerability amongst the Bantu-speaking peoples of Central and Southern Africa. Now I can get cancelled also for that. So we've given each other about 10 cancelled reasons. 10, but that's what I think. It's not to do with the way people have sex or how much sex they have. If you have that particular kind of sex as a gay man that I described, you are at 40% risk of a first instance HIV transmission. Yeah. And we see almost the same figures amongst young black people. You know, there was a survey done.
You're saying young black heterosexuals?
Yes, exactly. And let me tell you, I've looked for the survey. I've actually asked the medical class at WITS to try to find it, which I was told about in North Carolina by the medical school at Durham, North Carolina, and by the medical school in KwaZulu-Natal around about 2008, which followed a cohort of young teenagers. The teenagers in Durham, North Carolina, had more sex than those in Umlazi and Kwamashu. But the ones in Kwamazi and Kwamashu were much more susceptible to HIV. So we don't know. And the ignorance, as we know, ignorance breeds ignorance and racism and stereotyping.
Hmm. Well, I think that definitely answers my question. Final question from me is specifically, and I think because you are someone who represents your community, what do you think needs to happen, but specifically in the homosexual community or the LGBTQ community, what work needs to be done? And let's talk specifically then South Africa, because we are one of the highest rates of HIV prevalence in the world. What do we need to do? What advice would you give to someone in the community? And that, with you acknowledging that certain sexual practices confer a higher risk of transmission?
Enormously. I really think that awareness and education are primary, because we stopped that. You know, 20 years ago, we were educating young people.
Yeah.
And we were educating specifically people in the men having sex with men, who even those who don't identify as gay. I would say we have to start that again, and we have to inform people. I spoke about living on ARVs is better than having insulin dependent. You don't want to get HIV. I promise, if you're a young man having sex with other men, I beg of you, be careful. Be careful with condomize, take PrEP or post-exposure prophylaxis, which you've discussed on this podcast. Mm-hmm. But just be careful. I beg you to love, but love carefully and love respectfully and love with shared information. You mentioned, Doctor, that there is a stigma inside the men who have sex with men, queer, gay-identifying community. There is. And we need to remove that stigma. I cannot transmit HIV to anyone. And once you're on effective ARV therapy, it expunges the risk of HIV transmission. But you don't want to get there. That's my message.
Fish, anything? Any last question?
I think it was very informative having you as well, yeah, Judge. I think it's more like medical type of things. I wouldn't really say it's like for a podcast type of thing. But I mean, in terms of any like opportunistic infections or things like that, have you, I mean, you don't have to obviously answer, but have you like encountered any of this while being on ART?
No. At the time I started on ARVs in November 1997, I had PCP, the pneumonia, pneumocystis carinii pneumonia in both my lungs. I had gastrointestinal thrush. I couldn't eat. It was very painful swallowing. And I was very sick indeed. And then I started on Bactrim for both my lungs. I got that wonderful drug, the antifungal. The name escapes me now. Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. You see, very good to be with doctors. The most remarkable, you take one fluconazole and you're feeling better within hours. So since then, I've not had anything like that. And that's part of the reason why I speak out, is that I'm so grateful for the last nearly three decades of my life. They've been the best decades of my life, and they were after I started on ARVs. But anyone listening, don't put yourself in the position where you've got to start on ARVs.
Yeah, 100%. Prevention is definitely better than cure. And thank you. We are grateful for you being here and for sharing a lot of your insights and knowledge. And hopefully we'll get you and Prof back again to talk more. Unfortunately, we've run out of time for our episode this week. But tune in next week. And if you guys have any questions or would like to seek out therapy, such as pre-exposure prophylaxis or post-exposure prophylaxis, visit us at jensclinic.co.za, book a consultation with one of us, and let us help you on your journey to prevent or to treat HIV. That's it from me. It's been another lovely episode. I'm signing off. Dr. Sohail Essa.
Dr. Ntantla Vilagazi.
Dr. Vishay Naidu.
And Edwin Cameron. Thank you.
Thank you again for joining us. And we'll catch you next week. Cheers.